Detectives are questioning a man on suspicion of murder after an imam was fatally attacked in Rochdale. He was found with a serious head injury after leaving prayers at a mosque last night and died in hospital a short time later. Assistant Chief Constable Rebecca Sutcliffe is from Greater Manchester Police.
We're really keen to understand the motive. We're keeping a completely open mind. Of course, as a police service, we are also asking ourselves the question about whether it might be racially motivated. But at the moment, we just cannot say one way or the other.
David Cameron has cancelled a planned cabinet meeting this evening as haggling continues at the summit in Brussels over his EU reform deal. The Prime Minister had hoped to be returning to Westminster by now with all of the negotiations done and dusted. More than a dozen houses have been damaged in an explosion that claimed the life of a 63-year-old man in Haxby near York this morning. One home was reduced to rubble following the suspected gas blast. Facebook is introducing a new feature in the UK to help users who may be feeling suicidal. The suicide prevention tool lets people flag up troubling posts from their friends to a special team at the social network. And Shia LaBeouf is spending 24 hours in a lift at the Oxford Union. The actor's talking to students and is live streaming his conversations on YouTube. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is leader of the Labour Group and councillor for Whitchurch Park on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, about the new news about the November Paris attacks, it looks like the main suspect didn't do it after all. And whatever happened to Richard Tomlinson, the MI6 spy, who released a sworn statement that he saw a British Secret Service plan to murder Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic, orchestrated in a high-speed car crash in a tunnel, using the exact same method, Tomlinson says, and a flash to disorientate the driver, which was used when Diana died in 1998. Tonight we take a look at two senior MI6 figures and how their apparent involvement, actually it was 97, wasn't it? And that death of Diana, it led to knighthoods and their meteoric rise to power. Both joining notorious US criminal Henry Kissinger at the secretive Bilderberg conferences. And staying with Kissinger, the Prince of Darkness, Bernie Saunders makes Kissinger the clear dividing line between himself and the other hopeful for the Democratic nomination in the US, Hillary Clinton. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius and some rain. This weekend, highs of 11. A cloudy and windy weekend with outbreaks of rain on Saturday and Sunday. Next week, it's highs of 10 Celsius, sunnier but cooler for most of the week, with outbreaks of rain still. Next weekend, 27th and the 28th of February, that is, highs of 7 Celsius, cooler again, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Whitchurch Park 2. That's Helen Holland. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
First question has got to be, you've got a new leader in the Labour Party nationally. Who did you vote for?
Well, I voted for Yvette Cooper, but one of the things that I'm absolutely encouraged and excited by is the number of people who've joined the Labour Party since, and membership continues to grow since the new leadership was elected, and engaging with those new members right across Bristol at a very important time for Bristol has been one of my priorities. So Jeremy's the leader. He won by an absolutely stonking majority, and that's great with me.
Does it does sort of indicate you maybe you're out of touch with the membership if you didn't vote for the same candidate, more of a right-wing candidate, than the general membership of the Labour Party did?
Well, if I'm honest, the one of the reasons why I voted for Yvette was about thinking that it's about time that the Labour Party had a woman leader. And that doesn't mean to say that I would have voted for anybody irrespective of the politics. But I think it's funny, actually, if you look back now, we were talking about this just a couple of days ago with other colleagues, that this time last year we were still up in the run-up to the general election, and obviously Labour Party people were still thinking that we were going to win that election. And really the landscape has changed so much since then that what I do is, as I say, I absolutely celebrate the fact that Jeremy's leadership has encouraged a huge new level of engagement, not just in Bristol, obviously, but right across the country. And Labour in Bristol is by far the largest political party. I'm not talking about on the council, party membership in Bristol, more Labour Party members in it than any other party. And we've just got to engage with those members, find out what it is that they join for. It isn't just because they want to, you know, endlessly discuss things as it's sometimes portrayed. People are hungry for politics to be done differently.
Well, they certainly are. And Yvette Cooper, though, isn't really, excuse me, isn't really the person to do that. Surely she is the partner of Ed Balls, and they were very similar, came from a very similar kind of area politically. Ed was so, I suppose, you know, voters disliked him so much they decided they wouldn't even re-elect him, poor guy.
As I say, that was then, and this is now, and one of the things that I'm doing is meeting lots of new members, and it's very, very encouraging and very exciting to be part of that movement.
One of the really controversial things that's come out from the Conservatives this week is this possibility of having a ban on Israeli boycotts. So there's quite a big campaign around the Western world talking about boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israelis, looking at their treatment of the Palestinians over the last few years. But I mean, there seems to be no let up over there, and a lot of people are saying, well, it's actually just as bad as apartheid South Africa. There's a racist state. Anyway, what do you make of that? I was hoping on the BBC Question Time they were going to bring this up, but they never do. They never do bring up Israel.
But actually the ban is a wider one, isn't it? It's a ban on local authorities and public organisations making any decision on the politics of you know, whoever it is that they contract with, and being told that they can't. And I tweeted about it actually when I saw the story, because I was disgusted. Because, you know, on the one hand, you would have the Tory government and Greg Clark as the local government secretary telling you that it's all about devolution and local decision making. He wants to put more power in the hands of local councils. And then it's constrained by rules that, oh, by the way, you can't make a decision like that. And you may be aware that in the autumn, the council voted on a motion to encourage the Avon Pension Fund not to invest in fossil fuel any longer. Well, presumably that would also be stopped by this legislation were it to go through. So I just think it's so extraordinarily heavy-handed, and it's the antithesis of saying that, you know, we want local authorities to have more power.
Well, we've got our journalists' union conference coming up in a few weeks' time, and that's going to be one of the big debates
at that
journalists' union conference about whether the entire union should recommend boycott. You know, so maybe this is one of the reasons why the powers that be have decided that this. Martin, let's just bring you in on this because it is a biggie, isn't it, for the central government to be saying to local authorities and other public bodies, no, you cannot even vote on this. You can't make decisions based on boycotting any country, particularly though in this case Israel.
Well, I find it very odd when we're carrying out sanctions against the Russian Federation, when in actual fact many of it's, as we've covered on the show frequently, it's not even clear that they're responsible, that in many ways they've been provoked. But the central government in Britain certainly believes in sanctions. It's absolutely crazy, of course. It's crashing the economy in places like Poland and Hungary, but we're doing it anyway, mad as it is. But local authorities can't make decisions like things like this.
What sort of reasons might there be that you might want to boycott Israel, though?
Well, I mean, if you think about they've done the same thing in the United States of America with the Supreme Court changing the rules there, because what actually brought down apartheid in the end in South Africa was the big cities like Chicago and New York and so on withdrawing their funds from people who were investing in South Africa, and at that point the multinationals threw in the towel. And I think the leadership in South Africa would recognise that that was an absolutely key manoeuvre in bringing apartheid down. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I think it's very interesting that they now are trying to prevent similar things being done to the Israelis, at the same time as pushing sanctions on Syria, sanctions on Venezuela, sanctions on Russia. Well, they're not against sanctions, they're just against sanctions on Israel. And that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And Helen, your Bristol Labour Party here, you say you've got lots and lots of members. I mean, I think you would expect and you would hope that the Labour Party would have done better if you've got so many members. What's gone wrong at the council? Why is it that other parties, the Greens, seem to be where they're growing all the time? The Labour Party is actually not, is it? On the council itself, even though you've got the membership.
That isn't strictly speaking true, is it? Our numbers, I think, last year stayed, I'm trying to remember exactly, stayed the same. Over the last few years, we've gained, because at our lowest, unfortunately, we went down to 17 members. We're now at 29, because sadly one of our members, somebody who you've had on this show very many times, Ron Stone, died at the new year. So we're the largest party by some measure in the city council, and we've got all out elections for the first time for 20 odd years in May coming up, and we'll see what what the effect, both of obviously there's going to be the mayoral election and the police and crime commissioner election on the same day. So hopefully there'll be a higher turnout in the mayoral election. People will be electing councillors to represent them for the next 4 years. And we'll see what people, how people vote in those elections. Because it isn't true to say that we've been losing out to the Greens. It's the Lib Dems who lost out to the Greens last year.
Also, one of your local members is John Savage, who stood for the PCC, Police and Crime Commissioner, last year, didn't he? He had to stand in at the last minute. But, I mean, looking at him, I mean, he's a former Master of the Merchant Venturers. He's also the chair of the United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust, big NHS trust. I saw a thing with him on the BBC just after the 2010 election, actually calling for the reduction in state pensions, saying that they weren't fair enough, that sort of thing, and calling for a reduction in the public sector. Is that actually really Labour Party policy?
Well, I haven't heard John saying that, and he was the Police and Crime Commissioner candidate last time round, but you may have seen that this time our candidate has just been announced this week, and that's Kerry Barker, and hopefully you'll get Kerry on the show before the elections and you'll be able to hear what his view and current policy is.
Well, what we're hoping to do is to have all of the PCC candidates on and have a roundtable discussion at some point, in the month or so beforehand. But I mean, you happy having merchant venturers as part of the Labour group?
Well, it's not part of the Labour group, part of the
in the party. Quite influential, I'd imagine.
John doesn't live in Bristol, so meetings that I go to with Bristol Labour Party, he wouldn't be eligible to go to those. So, but I think that what the membership that has. The new membership that's come since Jeremy became the leader has shown that actually it's a really, really broad church. Yes, there are people who were Labour Party members in the 90s and have rejoined. They're energised by that influx of new members. There are people who've never been members of political parties, and there are people who've left other political parties to come here. So I don't think that we're constrained by what kind of members we want. We want them all. We want to have that debate amongst the membership. And the really important issues that face both the country and our city are ones that has the widest possible debate amongst the membership.
If we go back to 2007, I was looking at some old news stories about this, and you probably hate me dragging this up, but you did a deal with the Tories, didn't you? Because the Lib Dems were the bit largest party in the city. They'd been voted in the local elections and they had more councillors than everyone else, and you actually put your hand across the chamber and did a deal with the Tories.
No, it wasn't quite like that. I mean, that's how it resolved itself.
Give us your version of events.
Well, it isn't my version. Of course, it's exactly what happened. If you remember that in 2007, the Lib Dem administration, the then Lib Dem administration, were going forward with the privatisation of home care, and it was deeply, deeply unpopular. And you might remember, because I think we're in, are we in Lawrence Hill Ward here or Easton, one or the other anyway, but in particular in those wards, the impact of it electorally was very, very strong. So the then executive member who was taking that forward was the Easton councillor, Lib Dem councillor, and he lost his seat over it. And so the Lib Dems were the largest party, but they didn't have a majority. And so in that circumstance, you have to have agreement about what kind of an administration is formed. And I think that everybody went to the annual council meeting assuming that the Lib Dems would take minority control. But it became very clear that if they did that, they weren't going to change their policy on the privatisation of the home care service. And so, interestingly, because I've been in that council chamber for quite a few years, I'd never seen this before, that because normally people will, as they say, sit on their hands to see a minority administration agreed, even if they don't agree with it themselves, because that's the way that the electorate had voted. And so even though they hadn't got a majority, they were the largest party. But cross-party, the rest of the chamber did not want to see the Lib Dems carry on if they weren't going to change that policy. And extraordinarily, I mean, it wasn't planned at all, my name was put forward. I was the leader of our group, and I can remember, and I've often told this story, that I must be probably one of the only people who ended up as a council leader who was texting home from the meeting going, it looks as if I'm going to come home from this meeting as the leader of council. And so the Tories, you're right, again, unexpectedly, it wasn't planned, the Tories supported us as being a minority administration, even though we weren't the largest group. And that's what happened. And we had the administration for coming up for 2 years.
Of course, home care was privatised. What's it meant now?
I think that you'll find that the proportions are less than they would have been had it gone for the full privatisation. And there still certainly are home care workers within the city council. But again, the context of social care has changed so much, and closer working with public health and so on has changed that.
Well,
but it is one of the areas, and I hope that we're going to come on to talking about this, that the budget that was passed earlier this week with the George Osborne tax, as many councils have labelled it, the 2% that you're allowed to precept for social care to try and fill that massive gap that not only Bristol, nearly every local authority in the country has got, has been allowed by the government for local authorities to accept the ability to be able to levy an extra 2%.
So how come we as council taxpayers are paying more and more all the time for less and less?
Well, you tell me, because the austerity measures that the coalition government brought in 2010, saying it would all be over by 2015 and we'd have a balanced budget, has gone way, way short of the mark. And I can give you the figures in Bristol. The gap, the overspend in social care is 6.9 million this year. And the 2%, this is why Labour councillors voted for the 2% social care precept that's being allowed by the government, will only raise £3.5 million. So it isn't even going to stop, it isn't even going to fill the gap from that.
Well, where's all that extra money going then?
Because that extra money is going because the demands on social care are ever greater, that more people live longer, and that's a good thing, of course. But by the time they need care, the complex packages that they need are more expensive, and it can be very, very expensive, I'm sure you know, both to keep older people in care, and at the other end, the number of children coming into local authority care is growing, and the cost of keeping those children in care is more. So the demands are more, but the government is choking off the money that used to come to local authorities. And as you probably are aware, by 2020, it's this government's intention that there won't be any money coming to local authorities through the rate support grant, which is what it has been called historically, and that councils will be responsible for raising their own funds through business rates and retaining business rates. But that is a bit of a smoke and mirrors job as well, because a place like Bristol, where we actually collect more business rates than we get back from the Treasury, there will still be mechanisms put in place so that we can't keep all of the business rate raised here, because of course there will be other authorities who don't collect as much business rates, some of the northern authorities, where the demands are also greater, and they will have to find a way of kind of levelling the playing field. So those people who welcomed keeping retention of business rates, and I do support that, but not when it's being used as a cover-up for further cuts on local authorities.
Just sounds like a kind of financial train crash, really, because we're running out of money fast. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of all this, particularly with Helen's saying there about the rate support grant going down to zero?
Well, I mean, it's becoming incredibly blatant, isn't it? In the run-up to the May elections, Conservative-controlled county councils in the south of the country are being given an extra £3 million they've found behind the bottom of the back of the sofa so that they don't have to close some of their children's centres and what have you. And meanwhile, on Merseyside, where Knowsley is probably the most deprived borough in Britain, they're being cut to the bone. And of course, we've got a story here, Tony. Social services cuts could be the largest factor in the biggest annual rise in deaths for almost 50 years. We're now starting to see the rise in death rates that you saw during the collapse of the Soviet Union and the so-called economic reforms in Eastern Europe. That's what 5-6 years of Tory government
does. Well, it's interesting that Boris Johnson at the Conservative conference was boasting about the wonderful longevity of Londoners. This is, you know, sort of, I suppose, his party's policies kicking in to see that actually what's happening is it's going the opposite direction. But look, let's just try and keep it local and a bit more up to date, Helen.
You were the one who asked me about 2007, and I really had to rack my brains.
I know, there you go, you see. Right now, there's a bit of a struggle over the Malcolm X Centre and also, of course, the St Paul's Carnival. There's another one I've come across, which is the Bristol Dance Centre, which is really nationally successful, having its lease terminated by the City Council, although I don't think it's the City Council's direct responsibility. Also the Deaf Centre in King's Square closing. It seems almost all of these, many of these really important community facilities, the Council is either intervening or has allowed them to sort of, actively closing them, or decided, well, we don't like the community running these things, we want to run them ourselves. We don't like the community, the people the community have chosen to run St Paul's Malcolm X Centre, for example. We are going to decide we want these people running it.
Well, I think there's some separate issues here, so try and break them down. One is that obviously at a time of reducing budgets, big choices have to be made. But having said that, the fact is that on some of these issues, because of the mayoral system, which is very opaque, we don't find out about some of these things until almost it's too late. So decisions that were taken, I've had some correspondence about the dance centre on Jacobs Wells Road, and I was unaware that those decisions were going through the system. And so we do have to find a better way.
But what's the point of having councillors if councillors don't know what's going on?
Well, but you only know what's going on if you're either asking the right questions, and if you didn't know that they were under threat, then why should you know to ask those questions? And with something like Malcolm X and with the St Paul's Carnival, these are both really, really important community facilities and community festivals that really help build the communities. And so I think you're right that you have to have the right balance between the council being assured that everything's going well and the right procedures, all of those things are happening with those organisations, but also making sure that they have the support in place. So that if you've got committees that run them, that they're getting the right advice.
Okay, let's just go with these,
they're not just left
these two things in St Paul's, the Carnival and Malcolm X, one by one. Are both of them, is it justified for Ferguson to intervene in both of these?
Well, my understanding is that they're slightly different. So in the case of St Paul's Carnival, both the council and the Arts Council, who were their majority funders, both felt that they weren't happy with the then arrangements. But in both in the case of both funders,
if you've looked at the detail, do you agree with them?
In the case of both funders, the money has been that St Paul's Carnival, under new management, if you like, can draw down the funding, both from the Arts Council and the City Council. So I really hope that can be sorted, and we can get a management committee or a management process underway that will draw down that money, because it's really important that St Paul's Carnival
exists. What's happened
exists.
With Carnival is that it's like a big ton weight has been held over the heads of the people trying to organise it by the police, basically saying, look, if you don't do this and this and this, jump through this hoop, we won't let you have a licence.
Well, I mean, public safety is paramount, isn't it? So if the rules have changed about how the police police big events, and they have, you know, you think of something like the Harbour Festival. Years back, they didn't even have the water blocked off, despite the huge crowds. They didn't have the one-way system on the bridges that they do now. So things are changing all the time about public safety.
Tens of thousands of people turning up, you can never guarantee safety, can you?
No, of course you can't guarantee it, but it's their responsibility to have as many as of the foreseen problems sorted, so you can understand why that is. But this is what I come back to, that the council needs to, rather than just saying, well, you're on your own, you know, sort this out, the support mechanisms need to be in place, that the committee has the right people on it who've got experience of running big events and can do that and take tick the boxes.
But it comes down to the right people, doesn't it? Who decides who are the right people? St Paul's or George Ferguson?
Well, it's all
the police.
It needs to be St Paul's Carnival, that the committee are people who both have the confidence of the local community, but also can do those processy things, which isn't what Carnival's about. You know, when you go to Carnival, like when I do, I'm not thinking about, oh, have they filled these boxes in correctly. I'm thinking about having a good time.
And the police did exactly the same thing around about 2007, 2008, I think it was, with the big green gathering happening up on the Mendips. They just said at the last minute, no, we just don't think that you've done enough work to make this event totally safe, so you can no longer have a licence. I mean, surely the police shouldn't have a veto in that way on public events.
Well, they do have a responsibility, don't they? And I don't know enough about the other event that you've talked about, but I can see that they have a responsibility. But I do agree with you that we do need to have, those festivals need to be locally owned, and people need to be supported to make sure that they're ticking the boxes, so that they can draw down the money that's been promised, has been, you know, left in a jam jar marked St Paul's Festival by both the City Council and the Arts Council, and we need to draw that money down and work with the community to make sure that we have festival in the future.
Martin, the pressure is both on Carnival and on Malcolm X is to make money and not to be something which we pay as council taxpayers. The council gives a community group a whole lot of money to put on a festival. They want to do both with both Malcolm X and the Carnival.
Well, I think there are a number of fact things here that you need to take into account. Public money, whenever public money is spent, there's got to be accountability. Nobody gets money for free from anybody.
Oh, like Bristol Green Capital, for example.
Indeed.
We'll come on to that.
The other point is well made. If you remember, not that long ago, the police started talking about political demonstrations would have to pay for the policing of the demonstration, which basically is, it was knocked back, but they pushed for it. And I think that with the St Paul's Carnival in particular, there is an attempt to try and make it completely crime-free. Now, if you've got tens of thousands of people in a situation like that, there is going to be some incidents. And that's not a reason to... I mean, football matches have incidents all the time, but we don't cancel them, do we? It's a question of balance. And I think the balance may be going too far in favour of we've got to have everything completely covered, otherwise we're not going to allow it to happen. And certainly, as I say, they tried to make political demonstrations that you must pay for the policing of your political demonstration or you can't have it. That's not acceptable. You might be demonstrating because you've got no money, for example.
I was down at Malcolm X Centre last night for a showing of various films about the origins of the St Paul's Carnival, where I spoke to a chap called Naya about this.
I am Naya, and just this evening I heard about what's taking place here, and being a member of the community, I said, like, it was appropriate for me, like, to, you know, to be present. Hear what's happening, what has happened in the past, what's happening now, and where we'd like to go in the future. The thing is, like, it's all about preserving our people's culture, because music and all these kind of cultural events has always been a part of the Afro and so-called third world people's culture. So we love the culture and we do anything to promote our culture. So it's all about keeping our culture alive.
And do you think it's going to be okay to make it a more commercial carnival?
No.
That people have to pay to come?
No, anything too commercial always be like watered down, and then it's when you dilute something, it's just not as what it was before. You know, if we need to get back to how it was originally and what it was really about, instead of just about business. Too often now, business has taken over our lives, and then everything that pertaining to us and humanity has been lost in the interest of business, because that's, we know that's some people, society's agenda, especially those who promote like capitalism and all these systems that belittle people.
Yeah, but it sounds to me as if maybe there won't be a carnival then, if you don't want to have it as a big commercial event.
Nah, man. We always play music no matter what we do, whether we are playing football, cricket, dominoes, just at home eating or just chilling out, because we know that music has a positive message to send. And not just the music, but the music carries a very positive message to people. So anything that's promoting our culture, we are all for it. And not just business and money.
Well, I think that's a really interesting clip. And I hadn't heard that there's any suggestion that people should have to pay to attend St Paul's Carnival. And one of the other budget amendments that we put through earlier this week was to give £10,000, that the council should put £10,000 to Pride. And Pride is now the third biggest festival in the city in the year. And you have to think about the huge multiplier effect of, you know, the £10,000 that the council's going to put in, all those people who come to Pride, people from outside Bristol who stay in the hotels, who go and eat at restaurants, drinking, enjoying themselves. That's a great big economic effect. And I think when you talk about the commercialization of St Paul's Carnival, I don't want to see it commercialized, but I do want to see every way possible to make the economic impact of it greater in our city. And we know that people from all over the country come to St Paul's Carnival and would carry on coming.
Well, if it was gangs from Birmingham.
if it was what it was originally.
Anyway, let's go on to talk about Green Capital now, because I'm interested in what the Labour Group's position is on this. I noticed the Bristol Post on the 7th of February said, we say, and this is one of their sort of opinion pieces, editorial, how Bristol builds on Green Capital is more important than scrutinising the spending. Bristol marked the end of its time at Europe's Green Capital with a glitzy ceremony at Colston Hall, they say. We can be proud of our city. But they're effectively saying, Helen, it doesn't matter how the money was spent, or at least what they think anyway, at the Post, that everything's been done and dusted and there's no questions. Whereas the Lib Dem group, particularly amongst others, some including people who were beneficiaries of grants from Green Capital, have said that there's just not enough transparency because this was a company, limited company, that was spending this money, that councillors and others who were involved in raising the money in the first place, public money, aren't being told the way it was spent.
Well, I'm afraid I disagree with the Evening Post. That's not the first time that that's happened, by the way. But, it isn't the legacy and how Bristol builds on Green Capital is more important than scrutinising spending. Actually, both of those things are really important. And I do think that the legacy question is one that we've consistently been asking. Once all the glitz and the glamour is over, and we're now in that position, what happens? What's changed? What's changed for people whose lives weren't really touched by green capital? Well, nothing. But on the other side of this equation is that public money needs to be accounted for. Martin's already said it. And within the council, you can go on the council website, and every spend more than £500 is supposed to be logged.
Yeah, this is 7 million. I'm not saying they haven't accounted for any of it. They have a little bit.
But it's very broad brush, isn't it?
Didn't the Labour Party have somebody on the board of this Bristol 2015 Limited? Because if I was you, I'd have really tried to make sure that there was. So who decides who's on Bristol 2015? Is it just George's decision?
I don't know, but there weren't people from the political groups on 2015. There was a cross-party steering group, but there certainly wasn't anybody from the Labour Party on the board. And that's to be regretted, because I do think that even when the council has things at arm's length, so there's lots of organisations where the council fulfils its function, but through an arm's length body. I sit on one of them, which is Destination Bristol. So the council doesn't do tourism by itself, it does it in a partnership. But there's a member from every party sits on the board of Destination Bristol, and the same rules then apply, don't they? So we do know how they spend their money. And I think the problem with what the mayor's done is that the more he digs his heels in, the more people start thinking, well, there must be something there that's a bit dodgy. And so actually the best thing to do would be to put the accounts out there and it all to be absolutely transparent.
The fascinating thing about this is that quite a lot of the groups that have got grants have said, well, we're happy to tell everyone what money we got.
Well, exactly.
So why on earth, Bristol Green Capital, have you not prepared to do the same?
Exactly.
And my suspicion is, of course, reading the article, particularly really good article in the Bristol Cable about this, is that family of George Ferguson were beneficiaries of grants. And that one of the things that they found out in their report, and that was right at the beginning of 2015. So, we do need to have a bit of transparency. It's our money, after all.
It is our money, even if it's money that came from the government, because that was, that's money that's raised by income tax.
It certainly is,
and
it doesn't surprise me that Stephen Williams was rather niffed about that. Look, let's just talk about Metrobus, because it's caused so much chaos in the city over the traffic over the last couple of weeks. I wonder whether it's actually causing more pollution over the next and delays over the next few weeks or months while the city's in turmoil because of it, that it's ever going to save. Initially, we were told with Metrobus, weren't we, that we were going to get five of them an hour. They've now said, oh, there's not enough money for that. We're only going to get three an hour. And hardly anyone is actually going to be using this thing. Think the motorway is still going to be chock-a-block. It sounds to me as if it's almost pointless, this. What do you think about the Metrobus?
Well, unfortunately, we're not going to know how many people are going to use it until it's up and running. And at the moment, I have to agree with you that the delays and the congestion and seeing the mess that the centre is in is just heartbreaking.
Look, this is the baby of something called the West of England Partnership. So who are? How accountable are they?
Well, the West of England Partnership is a partnership of all of the four authorities. The local enterprise partnership, so this is where it's a bit fuzzy, the local enterprise partnership, the baby of the coalition government who invented local enterprise partnerships, is one where it's predominantly business people and the four leaders, well, the three leaders and our mayor sit on that. But the transport board, which is taking forward the big strategic transport projects, is again the four authorities. So I think the thing is that people are a bit disappointed, because we've always had a shared vision about the transport plan, and it's recognised that you needed a step change in public transport to get more people using it. You might remember there used to be a plan for a tram light rail transit in Bristol like there is in some other cities. Unfortunately, Bristol, like a couple of other places actually, kind of missed the boat about government funding for that. And government does not fund trams now. So the places where there are trams who are getting further lines, like Manchester, Nottingham and so on, that's because they were in the first tranche of trams. There's no chance at the moment of getting government funding for funding a tram. So many people regard this as the kind of poor relation of the tram. So I think when you used to go to Manchester and see that it was being dug up because they were putting the tram in, you used to accept it because you were going to have a really modern way of moving a lot of people around.
Well,
but people don't quite accept that this is going to have that impact.
I think there's someone somewhere out there, maybe up at the university, can do a study to see the amount of delays that this blasted metro bus is causing, you know, right across the city, and actually measuring it against the savings that there's going to be over, I don't know, 10, 15 years before the whole thing breaks down or whatever, because it's apparently it's quite unreliable. And one of the cities that decided to do this guided rail in France only did it for 4 or 5 years, and then they scrapped it. They said, right, we're going to have a proper tram. This thing's hopeless. So we'll see how it all goes. I've been digging a little bit into, on the transport theme, into First Bus over the last few days, looking at First Group, the company that owns it, and only to discover that they nearly went completely bust a couple of years ago because they've got a massive £2 billion pound debt which they couldn't service. They'd paid for several years no dividends to their shareholders, and they've had to sort of remortgage their debt in order to survive. So almost if anyone is paying for fares on the First Bus, most of that money is not going into the pockets of the drivers or to make your buses work, folks. It's going to service this enormous debt in the US. Martin, you know, this is the way we're going now, isn't it? And of course, back in the old days, in the 1950s, Bristol had its own corporation buses that actually made a profit and fed money into the city for the council to spend.
Well, they also used to be cross-subsidised, so some routes are very profitable, other routes less so, and you can cross-subsidise if you've got a public authority. I mean, we've put up with basically third-rate public services in this country for a generation now, 30 years. We should have never privatised the buses in the first place. It was an idiotic thing to do, and we've never reversed it. In 13 years of Labour government, didn't reverse.
Helen, I think your candidate for mayor has been saying recently that he wants to nationalise the buses. He doesn't think they should be in private hands.
He wanted to nationalise them. I think he said that it would be good if the council ran its own buses. I think there's
well, that sounds to me like nationalising.
Well, it's
municipalising.
Okay, so right. So back to the way it used
whereas the Labour Party nationally have said that they would renationalise the railway, I think, because, you know, what we've seen is the division between the, you know, the network provider and the operators, all of those things. Of course, they all cost money, don't they? But I think that the thing about Bristol's transport is control. That's the big issue. And often people will say, well, in London they can do this and in London they can do that, but the rules in London are completely different. So one of the things that we want to do in Bristol is to have the same sorts of control over fares and frequency and emissions from the buses, to have more control over that so that we do have something where we can say this is how we want it to be and we're not at the mercy of the public transport operators.
Martin?
Well, yes, I mean, look at something like First Bus you've just uncovered. First is actually a US company which is massively in debt in the US and could easily go down. I mean, Wessex Water got taken over by Enron, who then disappeared in a puff of green smoke. And infrastructure companies have been sold and resold on the international market so that there isn't actually any mechanism for controlling what they do. And in any case, they could go bust at any moment, as National Health hospitals can now go bust, probably. And we've seen that, what's it, Southern Cross healthcare homes. All of this should never have happened. Never, and it should have been reversed.
Well, we've seen privatisation.
But it wasn't. Just like the deregulation of financial markets in the late 1980s, the jewel in the crown of the Thatcher era was a disaster. It has led to exactly where we are now, on the brink of the biggest crash in history.
Well, maybe. We've also seen this week announcement that postage stamps are going up again. I just did a little calculation, because I had an old post, charges book thing from 2011. And I was about to throw it away. I thought, what's that doing it? And I thought, no, hang on, I'll just see how much the stamps have gone up since 2011. And it turns out they've gone up, and of course this is when during the period Royal Mail was privatised, the final privatisation of Royal Mail took place, and it's gone up 25% within 5 years. So is that better value for money for the people actually using the service? Of course it's not. It's gone from, would you like to guess, Helen, what the first class stamp and the second class stamp, how they've changed over the last 5 years?
I don't know. Was it 40p?
It's gone from 46 pence up to 64 pence, the first class stamp. And the second class stamp has gone from 36 up to 55, both of them up 25%.
And the awful thing about this is, and you can't blame, you know, your postie. In fact, I was talking to a postie this morning when we were out in the Hartcliffe. And, you know, they know that they're being asked, as he said, to, you know, a quart to fill a pint pot. So they're being worked harder. But, of course, the number of people who, because of the marketisation of mail services, they're left with the least profitable bit. But the people who are most affected by this, people like my mum, who is still somebody who writes letters on a regular basis, she's 93 and she's expected to spend that on stamps. So
Martin, this money's going to shareholders, and it's also going, as we've just heard with First Group, to banks. Some of the shareholders are actually, you know, rebelling in these AGMs, saying no, we don't want these people running the company, because we're not getting any dividends on our shares. Even the money's just going to the banksters.
Well, that's what we're talking about first, Buzz. But I mean, the Royal Mail, of course, was also sold at far less than it was actually worth.
Absolutely.
A massive giveaway to the chums of the government, millions of pounds. Meanwhile, people are being chucked out of their houses because they can't pay the rent.
It's gangsterism, isn't it? Anyway, Bristol is on the verge of a property boom. Everything's going to be okay, because that's in the Bristol Post in the 23rd of January. I just noticed this, must have missed this one last week. We're on the verge of a property boom, according to one of the city's leading firms. Clifton-based JLL says Bristol is on the cusp of a watershed year when it comes to new offices, restaurants, shops and bars. The combination of strong economy, improvements in the city's transport network and a buoyant property market means all the conditions are in place for a mini boom. Martin?
Well, this Clifton-based JLL wouldn't sell property, would they? I think that's probably what they do.
I think this is just a press release, cut and pasted onto the front page of the Bristol Post.
But the problem here is,
people who sell property think property is going to go up in value.
Hmm. Well, and they're talking about a property boom, and it says new offices, restaurants, shops and bars. What Bristol needs in terms of a property boom, and I'm not talking about in prices, in getting on and building them, is housing. We have got a horrendous housing crisis in Bristol. And ask any local councillor, any of the people who come.
But we know that. What's
show?
Your plan for dealing with it, Helen?
What our plan is to, I mean, for one thing, the mayor would have been doing better if he'd achieved his own target, and he set a target that wasn't high
enough.
Well,
we know he's not done it. What are you doing? What would you like to do?
Right. Well, what Marvin Rees has committed to building more homes in Bristol, and to make sure that that's across a range of tenures, so social housing, homes to rent, homes to buy, and we'd need to get that property built. And on Tuesday at the council budget meeting, we did support a motion that came from the Tories, because it's kind of in the right area, which is to use some of the receipt from the port sale, and whether you agree with the leasehold sale or not, the mayor's done it
for 1% of what it was worth.
The mayor's done it, and there's £9 million that we voted on Tuesday to get into getting Bristol building, because we really need those houses. And having an arm's length company, it's been done in Birmingham, it's being done in Plymouth, and they're all doing far better than we are at building the houses that are so desperately needed.
We've got to talk about the economy now. I mean, in the background, of course, we've got this Euro train crash going on.
Haven't heard the latest. Are they still in there?
Don't hold your breath. I mean, yeah. I think there's 27 people that Cameron's got to convince, and they're all having like tea breaks and sleep breaks, and he's not getting anywhere with any of them, so we'll see how he
gets on. Well, it's not surprising, is it? Because, you know, when the crunch comes, it wasn't just about give the UK what they want, because people, if it's a negotiation, they're going to put things on the table aren't
they? I blame the mainstream media a lot for actually bigging this up, because as soon as the election last May, Hollande and Merkel, who basically run the show, said you're going to get nothing, yeah? And they said that straight away. You know, when Cameron was saying, well, we're going to renegotiate this, and then they said, no, you're not. So it seems to be as this has been built up as some sort of possibility, almost a kind of bit of theatre, Martin.
Well, yes, but I believe you've got a clip you're about to give
well,
us.
Well, I was. I'm going to play you a clip now. This is about the economy more generally, because there's no PMQs this week. They're on a break, on half-term or whatever they have. This is an economist at City University in London called Anastasia Nesvetilova, and this is what she said on Al Jazeera just the other day about the next financial crisis, which she totally agrees. I think you get on with her, Martin, like a house on fire.
To answer your question about where is this next crisis or recession going to be, I think the answer is more trivial. We are already in the recession for the simple reason that we haven't exited the previous one. And the explanation for my answer is very simple. The 2008 and 2009 crises were dealt with quickly, mostly by emergency measures by the central banks. But as your piece mentioned, structural reform, there was no, in fact, structural reform. The economies were not restructured. The job markets were not restructured. And most crucially, the financial banking systems were not restructured. There was a lot of regulation coming in, and it has been imposed. And in some ways, it's more clever regulation, and there is more knowledge about how finance works now. So there is more understanding of what is around the corner. But the structure, the key economic paradigm of oil-dependent and debt-driven growth is still there. The only difference this time is that we are lacking the safety cushion of emerging markets that came to the rescue in 2008 with huge liquidity injections and demand boost to the global economy. This is now missing, and therefore I do not think the markets are overreacting. The markets are pricing the future. At the moment they're pricing it negatively because there is no security of expectations about the future. There is very little sign of optimism for the global economy or for national economies.
Well, I mean, that's a fairly sober but realistic assessment of where we stand. What happened in 2008 was an emergency measure. I mean, if you remember at the time, Gordon Brown was really unhappy to use the word nationalisation of the banking system. So what we ended up doing was giving loads of money to prop up the asset values of the existing structure. And then, of course, what you should do at that point is have an orderly bankruptcy procedure for all of the major city firms. That didn't happen. And they've basically been making hay ever since then, supported by the government, including the British government. But of course, we've come to the end of that line.
Well, why is the BBC, the big financial places like the Financial Times, the mainstream press, the London press, so reluctant to put points of view like hers?
Well, it's what the Oxford economist Simon Wren-Lewis calls macro media. Don't forget that the JLL that we're talking about here, they sell property. So they're selling a property bubble in Bristol. They want a property bubble in Bristol. People who sell shares for a living are always talking about how good shares are. Why don't you buy some shares? And people listen to these people and think, oh, well, the people who sell shares think shares are a good bet. Well, people who sell shares would say that, wouldn't they? And these people just basically haven't got sufficient nous to realise that they're being bamboozled.
Well, she has making a really important point there, that nothing really has changed since 2008.
It's got worse. There's a far bigger debt overhang now, and don't forget that governments are now heavily in debt as well, because they went in to soak up the debt of the private banking system. Most of that debt should have been cancelled. All that rowing about what should have happened in Greece this time last year, what should have happened is most of the debt should have been cancelled. It was debt mostly to private banks in the north of the European Union, mainly Deutsche Bank. And therefore Deutsche Bank should have been allowed to crash. And Greece should have just walked away from the debt.
Everybody seems afraid to allow anyone to default on a debt because it would be like a
Yes, because what happens then? The whole thing's going to come down.
Yeah, exactly. But the problem is, you know, cast your mind back. There were queues at cash points, even at banks in this country. Mm. Northern Rock, I think, wasn't it? I'm just trying to remember. Mm. And people's mortgages would have gone down. So what the government then, the Labour government, did was right in stepping in to avoid the banking crisis becoming a personal crisis for family finances. But what the banks seem to have got away with it, and as they say, no bank has gone to prison, and yet what they did was criminal.
That's right.
The banksters, yeah, they get quite a lot of mentions on this show. But anyway, the Anastasia, just to remind you, we've been listening to the economist Anastasia Nesvetilova from City University in London, and here she talks about something called the shadow banking assets, and apparently there's quite a lot of them. These are the things we really need to worry about and get our heads around.
Last time, the central bankers and the regulators were to blame. They really mishandled the crisis. How can we be certain that the same thing won't happen again?
We cannot. Nobody knows. The financial system comes from one crisis to another. It was a miracle that 2008 only came in 2008. A lot of people had been expecting it sooner. And the only about 20 years of stability that we ever had in the 21st century was the so-called Bretton Woods era that was extremely short-lived, and the world economy at the time was very different. At the same time, if you look at the history of financial flows or capital flows, about every 5 to 10 years there is a major collapse. Usually it happened in emerging markets, but advanced financial systems were not immune. What makes a difference now is that there is about $125 trillion worth of shadow banking assets globally. It has grown since 2007. We are more in debt and we are less in ammunition. There is a difference between also the people who are dealing with the crisis. The regulators and the technocrats, as I said before, I believe they are better prepared. They had to learn. They have more data. They are, I think they're more in touch with the markets. But the politicians aren't.
Interesting that she's saying that the technocrats, the bankers, are more ready for this than the politicians are, and therefore us, Martin.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, actually. I think Steve Keane, the economist at Kingston University, say part of the problem is that the models of the economists are wrong. So there's two levels at which this is wrong. There's a kind of theoretical intellectual failure, the collapse of the Black-Scholes theorem, for example, in 1998. I could go into that. The technical acts, I don't know what they're talking about. Certainly the politicians don't. Who is going to turn around to people and say, right, there's going to be a major collapse. We're going to have to start rationing things. And don't forget, since we bailed out the financial markets, there's no guarantee that the money you've got in your bank account, especially if you're a millionaire, is your money. If we hadn't bailed you out, you wouldn't have it. Now, we did bail you out and you have got it. Now, from which resources are we going to retool our industry and prevent our population from starvation?
Helen.
From those resources,
from what Martin and Anastasia are saying here, it sounds like on the horizon heading towards us we've got a kind of tsunami and no one really wants to talk about it.
Well, I'm not an economist, but I tell you one thing is that, you know, the people at the bottom of the pile are made to feel as if it's their own fault that they're in a situation that they can't afford their rent or they haven't got a job, all of those things. And so that balance in society is wrong and it hasn't got any better. And I think when people hear the news and they hear about, you know, the number of jobless, the number of people in work and everything's getting better, that isn't how they experience
it. Well, HSBC are going to stay in London. Isn't that wonderful? Everything's going to be fine. And the other thing I found out was that the chief executive of HSBC is on this brand new organisation the government has set up called the Joint Fraud Task Force. So they're going to be investigating themselves, which I just found unbelievable. And maybe that's why they're staying in London.
That's why the technocrats know and understanding what's going on, eh?
Ah, I see what you mean. Okay, that's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now, thanks to our guest, who's been leader of the Labour Group, Councillor for Whitchurch Park on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. After the news, we look at the Paris November attacks. Looks like the main suspect didn't do it after all.
BCM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.